In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Power is not always seized by the strength of men, but often due to the weakness of men who give up their power rather than use it. And giving up is the fastest road to tyranny. Look, for example, at the Supreme Court of the 1930s. Their one job was to protect and defend the Constitution, but they folded. When FDR wanted to shove through a massive expansion of government, lurching us towards socialism, they initially said no. But then he threatened them with packing the court, expanding it with his far-left nominees that would side with him rather than the Constitution. So they folded. Rather than stand up to tyranny to defend the Constitution, weak men gave up their power. You are here right now at this time because you have been chosen for this fight. Just as our founders were chosen, anointed for their time, it's come down now to you to fight, to not be silent, to say no more to this massive expansion of government. You saw what happened in Virginia when they refused to be silent. America was founded with a constitution designed to guarantee and protect your rights, not give you your rights. You have those because those are God-given. But these rights are different and separate from the concept of justice. That's very different. Justice is not guaranteed, and justice is not always blind. And while justice is supposed to be blind, we're not. We can clearly see two tiers of justice, very different treatments by our legal system when you're a Democrat versus when you're a Republican. Just look at Hillary Clinton versus General Flynn. After Virginia and other elections a couple of weeks ago, after the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict of not guilty, after more and more exposure of the voter fraud and election theft and people finding the courage to expose it, it seems today there is an awakening happening. People are realizing they can't sit there quietly anymore, that it's time to tear off our own blindfolds and get back to our founding principles. Rights are God-given. Justice, at least on this earth, comes down to mankind, and that means to not let those who would rob us of both get away with it. Not anymore. Are you awake? I'd like to welcome back Jonathan Emord, who is one of America's top constitutional lawyers. He has beaten the FDA a record 8 times in federal courts, and he joined us last month for 2 shows to talk about his latest book, The Authoritarians, Their Assault on Individual Liberty, the Constitution, and Free Enterprise from the 19th Century to the Present. Highly, highly recommend that book. If you want to know how we got where we are and the infusion of socialism and the outright embrace of it by elected officials and bureaucrats, this is the book for you. You can catch the podcast version of those 2 previous shows by heading to iSpyRadio.com. Jonathan, it is great to talk to you again.
Oh, it's great to be with you again.
So last time we had talked, we had just barely scratched the surface, really, of the federal agencies that were put in place, how FDR shoved these through and greatly expanding the power of the federal government and even threatened to pack the Supreme Court to get his way. But those are just 2 of the 3 branches. Where was Congress during all of that? I know that they objected to the packing of the court, which had ruled that FDR's agencies were unconstitutional. So why didn't Congress also kneecap FDR's plans, especially since the Supreme Court had originally ruled that they were unconstitutional?
Well, you had a majority Democrat Congress, which was very much supportive of President Roosevelt. President Roosevelt won with significant majorities. He actually had a mandate, unlike Joe Biden. And as a consequence, his first 100 days in both of his first 2 terms in office were greeted largely with open arms and were ratified rather quickly. Congress wanted to act in the midst of a depression and show that it was doing as much as it possibly could to implement this new agenda, and they really did everything entirely the wrong way, but nonetheless, you had a massive federal takeover of the private sector, largely through the NRA, the National Recovery Administration, and its programs were so extraordinary that they controlled all wages, all prices, and all production of goods and services in this country through federal agreements, or really one-sided agreements insisted upon by bureaucrats over industry, and industry largely capitulated. Some, for example, the Ford Motor Company refused. Henry Ford said he would absolutely not do this. He was threatened, coerced. They told him that they would destroy his business, and he still stood up against them. And finally, Roosevelt mused that that was just the way Henry was, and he let him go. But the NRA was held unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, as were most of the alphabet soup agencies in the first part of the administration, all because they were in violation of the non-delegation doctrine, and they also violated the separation of powers doctrine in certain respects. And so then they had to come up with a new agenda, which became the Second New Deal. And in the Second New Deal, Felix Frankfurter played a very prominent role, and the new program was really one of heavy taxation and redistribution. And they gave up on this corporatist approach that they have largely adopted from Mussolini. Mussolini and Roosevelt were good chums. People don't realize that. And he actually sent members of the administration over to Rome to study Mussolini's fascism and to bring back those elements to this country that were successful there so that he could implement them here. But by most serious economists' measure, Roosevelt extended the time of the Great Depression by using this very heavy-handed approach. And, you know, of course, it's only through revitalization of the private sector that we're able to grow the economic pie. And ultimately what happened, as Morgenthaler, Secretary of Treasury, admitted in congressional testimony after the first 8 years of the administration, he said that he said that the entire thing had failed, that they had not produced a single success, and that unemployment remained far too high, and people were still hurting badly all across the country. So that's the origin of this administrative state. Notice that these agencies didn't disappear.
No.
They just continued on in different forms, and there were hundreds of them. And this created this new state outside of the constitutional branches of the government, which is ruled largely without restrictions from the Constitution, in much the same way any other tyrannical, all-powerful combination of legislative, executive, and judicial power works.
Hmm. It's amazing to hear you talk the similarities between FDR's time and what we've got going on right now, this massive expansion of government. And it's scary in some ways to think that if enough people in power agree to violate the Constitution essentially doesn't matter and can just be tossed aside.
That's most unfortunate, isn't it? And indeed, it was understood at the time of the founding of the Republic. In fact, James Madison referred to the Constitution as a mere parchment barrier when it came to those who were intent in using their offices to break constitutional barriers to increase their own power and wealth. And so they foresaw that this would happen, and they did their best to create a constitution that was resilient. It has been largely resilient to many attempts at violating individual rights, but what it has not worked to succeed in stopping was the creation of this this extra constitutional, outside the constitution, government of the administrative state, which has really ruled this country. Virtually all laws, not the product of those we elect, but rather the product of the unelected heads of these agencies.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It is really truly sad and ironic that here in America, we essentially have the freedom to destroy our own freedoms. Okay, more on those unconstitutional agencies and how we untangle this with Jonathan Emord. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking today to one of America's top constitutional lawyers, Jonathan Emord. The Constitution has been under attack for decades, especially with the rise of FDR's expansion of government, giving it control over so much of American life. As we learned in the last segment, it is essentially a government within a government. So you gave a presentation to the Trinity Health Freedom Expo about a year ago, and you said during that that the Supreme Court has deferred to the agencies for their rules and oversight, thereby effectively making these extra constitutional agencies, as you put it, with rare exceptions, the supreme law of the land. And because of this abdication of duty by the Supreme Court to say what the law is, doing so has firmly established a government outside the Constitution. And this really caught my attention there. You said defendants before the agencies are afforded very few of the protections that they would be entitled to in an Article III court of law, even routinely denied an independent judge. So talk to our audience about this. It sounds like effectively we have two legal systems, one in which there's a constitution and constitutional protections, and another in which the constitution essentially doesn't exist and the government has all the power. How is this possible that the constitution doesn't seem to exist within these administrative systems?
Well, that's definitely the case. It's possible because the courts have allowed it to happen. And a majority of the justices of the Supreme Court now seem to be indicating that they're going to change the precedent known as Chevron to disallow what has been gross deference, which has allowed for all sorts of mischief and deprivation of rights. The system created in the administrative courts is equivalent to the courts of Star Chamber and yes. High Commission in England that violate people's rights. And we can look at the Constitution and see all the rights that are not protected in administrative courts, and it's appalling. So, for example, there's no presumption of innocence in the administrative courts. You're essentially presumed guilty, and you have to prove yourself innocent. In addition, you have no right of discovery against the state, while the state has virtually limitless discovery against you. In fact, while the Fourth Amendment prohibits general warrants, in administrative courts, the government uses general warrants with impunity. General warrants have no restrictions, so they can ask for anything, virtually anything. And they can also do so without ever having to go to a court. The party interested in getting the information is the one that issues the warrant. So it's the prosecutor is in charge of issuing the warrants, not a judge. And then in addition to that, you have no right to confront your accuser. You don't even know who's accusing you of violating the administrative rule or regulations that you're being accused of. And what's more is you don't have a right to a trial by jury. So, and then perhaps most egregious of all, the very party that is accusing you of the law violation, ordinarily the agency heads, is the ultimate agency judge of your case. So the prosecutor is also the judge, in effect. And so there's no justice that's possible there. As a result, administrative courts are really kangaroo courts.
Is there any way during that process to force it into an Article III court, a constitutional court?
Well, there used to be, but not anymore. The courts have a doctrine of exhaustion that they require. In other words, you have to exhaust your administrative remedies before you can go to court. So unless it's an extraordinary circumstance where you can show that there is no possibility from the agency that you will receive redress of your grievance, you are disallowed the right to go to court. And as a consequence, you end up with a administrative record. And what's really tragic under the various doctrines of deference that the courts have adopted for administrative decisions, the courts defer both to the agency's findings of fact and its conclusions of law. So the agency simply construes facts that it wishes to, that support its case, cherry-picking facts, and then applies the law with an interpretation that is based on its statutory authority. And the courts almost never call into question that application. In fact, while they call it a substantial evidence standard of review, even what's known as a scintilla, barely anything, even a scintilla of evidence supporting the government's position is enough to justify an affirmance of the agency's decision against you.
Wow. So listening to you talk, in states like Texas and Florida, where the rule of law at least appears to be at the forefront of their political structure, do the governments there in those states actually fear the people? Do you think bureaucrats in government at any level actually fear the people anymore, or is that a dream that only lives in the past?
Bureaucrats don't fear the people at all. They are beholden to the political leadership of the agency, so bureaucrats look to the political leadership of the agency. But the political leadership of the agency is insulated from Congress and from the legislatures in the states, by and large, so that they don't fear the people either, because the people are so far removed. So there's no when you're not elected and you run, you have legislative, executive, and judicial power combined, which is the frequent situation with an agency. That's what James Madison described as the very definition of tyranny.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
You have so much power, and yet you're never required to account. Furthermore, they operate like cockroaches, and that the public doesn't see them. They operate as if they were operating in the dark of night, and they can steal us blind, and we realize we've been had, but only after the fact. And then it's so hard for us to pinpoint exactly why or who is responsible, because they simply operate in large measure without any public visibility at all.
Yeah, absolutely. Stay with us. More with Jonathan E. Mord coming up. Which wins out, the Constitution or administrative law? And welcome back. We're continuing our discussion with Jonathan E. Mord, one of America's top constitutional lawyers, about the Constitution versus the alternate universe of administrative law, where the government has all the rights and powers and you have none. Thank you, FDR. So, if push comes to shove, which wins, the Constitution or administrative law? Because we effectively have this playing out before our eyes, with the administration saying they have a right to force you to take a vaccine, regardless of religious beliefs or any other reasons. Who wins in that case?
Well, ordinarily, we have what's known as a constitution in exile. That's what Judge Ginsburg in the D.C. Circuit referred to it. That means that all of the power-limiting provisions of the Constitution have effectively been interpreted out of existence as far as limiting agency power. But that doesn't mean that in an extraordinary circumstance where an agency so deviates from its statutory authority and so violates the statute and the Constitution that it won't be punished. And that indeed happens, and that's what happened in the Fifth Circuit with these vaccine mandates. The court simply would not allow the agency any degree of deference. And furthermore, in that peculiar context, the administrative deference is not due for yet another reason, and that is the section they're talking about, Section 6C of the Occupational Safety and Health Act, is an exception to the Administrative Procedure Act. So there's no notice and comment rulemaking preceding it. It's just a straight power grab. So in that circumstance, the courts have said that a quote-unquote close look is warranted, and so they subject it to a degree of scrutiny that they otherwise would not. And in this instance, the Fifth Circuit held that the law both violated the Occupational Safety and Health Act provision for a temporary emergency standard, but it also violated the Constitution. And so they said there was a substantial likelihood of success by those who were challenging it on the merits, and they imposed a temporary restraining order, and will evaluate next whether or not to impose a permanent injunction. Because the multiple parties have sued all across the country, they've consolidated it in the Sixth Circuit. So it was the Fifth Circuit that issued the temporary restraining order. It will be the Sixth Circuit to determine whether it becomes a permanent injunction. But until then, it's no longer binding, because even OSHA has suspended the rule pending an ultimate decision by the Sixth Circuit.
So along those lines, how do you think this plays out? Do we have a right to say no to the government if it deems our unvaccinated bodies are a threat to society?
We do. And if the Constitution is followed and the statute is followed here, this thing will be dead as a doornail. And the reason for that is that, as the Fifth Circuit pointed out, under the Commerce Clause, we have to be active in interstate commerce, or at least affect interstate commerce substantially, in order for the government to have jurisdiction under the Commerce Clause and impose restraints on us. In this instance, there is no activity. The people are, by definition, inactive. They don't want to be vaccinated. And so there is no power under the Commerce Clause for OSHA to reach these people. There is no national provision in the Constitution or otherwise for a national vaccine policy. Vaccines, as the court recognized, as I've argued before too, vaccination is a state power. It's been recognized as a power reserved by the states under the Constitution. And then, of course, there is this non-delegation problem, which is that the president doesn't have any power to delegate to the agency. In the first instance, it would be, if it were possible, a power of Congress. Congress would have to have a statute that it was passed and a law created for the president to proceed. But even then, there is no constitutional foundation for such a law, so it shouldn't even exist there. In the statute, as I mentioned, they would have to show, it's very hard to show, that there's a grave danger. And the problem is that the statute was designed to interdict grave dangers that arise in the workplace, usually through chemical exposures and so forth. But what we have here is a ubiquitous danger. It exists outside of the work environment. It's everywhere.
It's got a recovery rate of 99.8% for most people. So it's not like,
right. So it's not grave in the sense that the statute and the courts have determined it to be. It would have to pose a mortal threat. And not only that, you have 160 million Americans who already have natural immunity. And natural immunity, given the numbers, means that huge numbers of people in the workforce in these same companies have natural immunity. They don't pose a grave danger to anybody, but yet they're forced to be vaccinated. And so it is with people who are working in isolation. And what's more, as the Fifth Circuit pointed out, OSHA itself, just a few months ago, evaluated whether it had the power to impose a vaccine mandate under this very provision and determined that it didn't have that power.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And that there was no grave danger within the meaning of the statute. So they did a 180 without any adequate explanation whatsoever of how they could suddenly find a power that they said previously didn't exist.
Yeah. Well, it's because it's Thursday now, I guess, rather than Tuesday.
Right.
If they find that they can't do a mandate, that it's illegal for the federal government to do that, does that mean these vaccine passports also go by the wayside?
Yes, it does. There's no foundation under the Constitution for this imposition under the Commerce Clause. There's no statutory hook, in other words, for legislation to be passed to impose a mandate. There's no power that the president has unilaterally to impose such a mandate for vaccine passports. So if this stands, and I would certainly hope it will stand. One never knows what a court or what three judges will do. It would mean that there would be no ability to impose a requirement for vaccination passports.
Hmm. Just real quick, do you think it occurs to the left that if the government can force an experimental vaccine into you against your will or deny rights of access to basic elements of society with these vaccine passports, is there anything that the government can't do going forward?
They don't care about that. I mean, if you're talking about those who subscribe to socialism and Marxism, power is, of course, a very dangerous thing. But if you embrace it and you believe that society needs to conform to dictates that are inconsistent with the outcomes you want, then you don't much care about the precedent that's established.
No.
And, ask Trotsky how it goes with advocating all power and then in the end being killed as a result of that advocacy.
Yep, yep.
I mean, these people don't understand that the sword that they're sharpening today to chop off the heads of those who they dislike is the very sword that will be used to chop their own heads off at a later date.
That is exactly right. Okay, it is time for a break. Coming back, more with Jonathan E. Mort on individual rights versus the common good. Stay with us.
We all know the government is supposed to protect our rights, except the government doesn't seem to know that. We're talking today to Jonathan Emort, a constitutional lawyer, and we've been having a fascinating discussion about that constant battle. So in that last segment, we were talking about the vaccine passports and the mandates. If these are all thrown out, does that mean that the government could be sued by those that have been injured by these vaccines when they've been forced to essentially take them against their will? And could the manufacturer also be included in that, since it complied with the government when they knew there was emergency use only? Is there a lawsuit here?
Well, the government could be sued where people were forced to take a vaccination based on the government's mandate during the time the government was insisting upon that compliance, because the courts have found without equivocation that there was no valid defense to the violation of civil liberties that stems from the mandates. As a result, under the Equal Access to Justice Act federal law, one may sue if your civil liberties have been violated by the government for your attorney's fees, and there are statutory caps to the amount that can be recovered, but nonetheless, there would be an opportunity to sue the federal government for violating your civil liberties and imposing a legal requirement upon you that was plainly from its origin forward a violation of your civil liberties. It was undeniably so. They did not have a substantial legal foundation for it. As a result, it's highly vulnerable to a suit under the Equal Access to Justice Act. Now, as far as the manufacturers go, there's separate legislation that has been passed that protects them from liability for vaccine injuries. And there is a vaccine compensation fund, but as I understand it, COVID vaccines are basically scot-free for the manufacturer. So if a person were to suffer injury, they would not be able to resort to suing the makers of the drugs. Now, they might well be able to sue on other grounds the employer because of the absence of a sound legal foundation for the imposition of the mandate, to the extent that the employer was imposing the mandate in compliance with the federal obligation. But there are many other employer related lawsuits that can be brought for discrimination in the workplace for those who object to being vaccinated on religious grounds or medical grounds and were not accommodated. That can happen under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Title VII, in cases of religious objections, and under the Americans with Disabilities Act under Title I, for objections that are based on pre-existing medical conditions that would be aggravated by the vaccine.
It sounds like there could be no end of lawsuits coming up here. You've got Fauci out there who is saying that you don't have a right to refuse a vaccine because, in his words, quote, there is a misplaced perception about people's individual right to make a decision that supersedes societal safety. In other words, it's a mistaken notion that you think that your rights somehow have more importance than collective rights. So, but talk to us about this intersection of individual rights versus society. Which one has supremacy, and how do you draw the boundaries there?
Well, our Constitution only recognizes individual rights, albeit the courts, particularly Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., interpreted the Constitution to effectively create collective rights by virtue of the fact that he misinterpreted the 14th Amendment into saying that if there's a health and safety reason that is articulated by the state, it is sufficient to compel you to be vaccinated. That was the Jacobson decision that he endorsed. And there have been subsequent vaccination decisions which say the same thing all the way up to the present. However, that is a detour from constitutional law, because under our Constitution, there are only protections for individual rights. There are no such thing as collective rights, and there can't be. And the idiocy of collective rights is well illustrated in the COVID context. This is a disease, the vulnerability of which varies from person to person based on your relative level of immunity and based on your relative health. And so one may contract the disease but not have a disease that is life-threatening. One may not contract the disease but carry it, and one may not contract the disease and not carry it. People who have natural immunity neither carry it nor transmit. They can't carry it, so they can't transmit it. and 160 million Americans have had it. Virtually half the American population has had this. They have natural immunity. They don't pose a threat to anyone. When it comes to people who are vaccinated, we know that the vaccine wanes. So just because you're vaccinated doesn't mean that you are protecting others. People who are vaccinated can carry the virus, so they can carry it and transmit it, even though they don't show symptoms.
Right.
But we know that at some point, their vaccine will wane, and that appears to be from 4 months, some people even sooner, to 6-7 months. They end up with far less immune protection than they had before. So as a consequence, the mere fact that you're vaccinated is not an assurance that you will not carry the virus and transmit it, or that you will not contract the virus yourself. In fact, many, many people who are in the hospital today with serious cases of COVID were vaccinated. So there's no panacea here, and this collective notion arises out of extreme ignorance as to the science and as to the transmissibility and as to individual differences. We cannot have a one-size-fits-all physician or approach to this disease. We ought to be, there's no mention in federal circles of treatment. There ought to be a massive investment and promotion of all the treatments available.
Yep, preventative measures.
Florida did that very successfully. Mm-hmm. And now they have the lowest rates among the lowest rates in the country of COVID-19. And they also have very effective intervention because mm-hmm. they have treatment centers mm-hmm. all around the country, all around the state. And those treatment centers rapidly deploy into someone monoclonal antibodies or ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine. And so they are giving people treatments that have proven very effective in diminishing hospitalization and serious illness.
Yes, absolutely. Jonathan Emort is our guest. He's a top constitutional lawyer and author of The Authoritarians. Coming up, more on individual rights versus collective rights and how we start untangling this mess. Welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking today about defending the Constitution and rule of law and moving away from socialism and collectivism. We're doing that with Jonathan Emort, one of America's top constitutional lawyers. Jonathan, you know, I imagine your head kind of probably exploded when you heard Fossey say that about individual rights essentially don't matter.
Yeah, that's exactly right, because that's a concept that may pass well in the former Soviet Union, in Russia today, or in communist China. But it's antithetical to the core principles that underlie our Constitution. And certainly, if you believe that, as many socialists in government do today, as I suspect Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, AOC, and all the squad believe today, then you're really not an American. Because if you wish to look at what defines an American, you need look no further than the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. And there you will find that our rights are individual rights, and that they're pre-political, and so they're not affected by public policy, which is post-political.
Yeah.
They are inalienable, as the Declaration of Independence makes clear. And that was the very purpose of having a written Bill of Rights, even though in their discussions and their correspondence, Jefferson and Madison debated the issue of whether there ought to be express provision made in the Constitution for rights which were protected by virtue of the power-limiting provisions of the mm-hmm. Constitution. The Federalist position was that the Constitution did not violate rights, so why make reference in a Bill of Rights to rights that are not even affected by the Constitution? And so Jefferson's wisdom prevailed, and he said that it would only have a salutary effect to add additional provisions for the protection of rights in those instances where government could predictably violate individual rights. There would be a specific provision that individuals could repair to in defense of their liberties. So that notion prevailed, along with the fact that James Madison was soundly criticized in his election to the first Congress by Patrick Henry for not advocating a Bill of Rights. He said that Madison was an enemy of the people's liberty. And so Madison, as a political matter, had to change, and he did. And then he followed through with his promise in the first Congress by introducing what ultimately became the Bill of Rights.
Hmm. So we've been talking about the administrative state and their unlimited power, including they think that they have the ability to force you to be injected with an experimental vaccine. Last time we had talked, you had mentioned a simple, straightforward law that would force the administrative state back under the Constitution, and this was a bill that you'd written for Ron Paul. Remind us about that and how that would work.
Yes, it was the Congressional Accountability Act, and the way that would work was that any regulatory agency that adopted a rule could not enforce the rule, and the rule would have no legal effect until such time as Congress passed it into law, and it was either signed by the president or vetoed and then overridden and became law. So it'd have to become law in the way in which the Constitution prescribes for law to be created, and it would have to be our elected representatives in Congress. So therefore, the people would be protected by their elected representatives acting on their behalf in the way in which we depend on in the democratic country. So we would no longer have this oligarchy operating of full power in the administrative state. It would be neutered, and instead the administrative state could not act unless Congress enacted the regulation into law. Otherwise, it would not be law. So it was called the Congressional Responsibility and Accountability Act that I wrote with Norm Singleton, the chief of staff for Ron Paul. He introduced it repeatedly to his great credit, and to their great discredit, a majority of Congress never saw fit to allow it out of committee. And of course they wouldn't, because it's against their own political interests. What people need to understand is that this has come to pass in no small measure because, that is the administrative state, because Congress has found it politically expedient to avoid accountability for the actions of the federal government that are controversial. So while you can stand and proclaim to the nth degree your great love of the environment and your favoritism for the creation of environmental laws, when it comes to shutting down factories and doing the dirty business of implementing these draconian strictures on free enterprise and individual liberty, you leave it to the EPA to do that. And then when your constituents complain, you just say, well, I didn't do that. That was done by the EPA. Here, let me write a letter to the EPA administrator and complain for you, knowing full well that that'll have no effect.
Exactly.
And knowing full well that you yourself are responsible for creating this entity outside of the constitutional branches that is wreaking havoc all across the country.
So obviously this particular Congress would not have any interest in such a law, but if projections hold true, we may have a very different Congress in 2022 and even more so in 2024. Have you run this law by other congressmen or senators, and what's been their response?
Yes. There are those who are conservative and who are principled, not Republicans in name only, have shown great interest in this. And it's particularly more interesting these days than it has been before, because they've seen such great abuses and they realize that unless something like this is done,
right, the
administrative state is going to really keep us in a perpetual state of misery. So I suspect in 2022, if Republicans do indeed succeed, as I think they will, in taking over the House and the Senate, that there will be receptivity to these measures. In fact, it'll be a lot of new blood coming in who will be interested in seeing that rather than just talk the talk, that they actually do things to roll back government and limit its power and scope and restore constitutional checks and balances and take on the Biden administration by limiting these agencies, which otherwise Biden will simply use. Biden has no compunction about breaking the Constitution, and his willingness to use the administrative state to do legislative work is legion now, because he's done it so frequently. So he could lose the Congress, but he'd just merrily continue right along using the administrative state to impose law.
Oh, exactly.
So the only way Congress can stop that is by defunding these agencies and by neutering them, as I mentioned, with this Congressional Responsibility and Accountability Act.
Well, that would be awesome. Okay, stay with us. We'll wrap things up with Jonathan Emord, a constitutional lawyer and author of The Authoritarians. Coming up, holding people accountable.
Thank you.
In America today, it's the Constitution versus the government. Not at all what our founders had intended. The government is supposed to protect our rights, but over the decades, the government has been actively robbing us of those rights. Wouldn't it be nice for a little justice? We've been talking with Jonathan Emord. His latest book is The Authoritarians, and he is one of America's top constitutional lawyers. So, Jonathan, let's talk about that, holding people accountable. We see this at all levels, especially there's a very different rule of law, it seems, for Democrats versus Republicans. We've seen it where Bannon is now being held in contempt of Congress versus Eric Holder, that he was actually working for the administration and defied Congress. Nothing ever happened. Now you've got Garland out there with this explosive whistleblower documents that apparently are revealing that he knew all about this, or somebody at the FBI really did unleash counterterrorism operations against concerned parents after this whole domestic terrorism letter. So how do we start holding these people accountable?
Well, we have to have uniform application of the rule of law, regardless of political affiliation. No one should be above the law. Everyone should be held to account. And we haven't had that for a very long time, all the way back even before Hillary Clinton. But Hillary Clinton is a classic example. James Comey let her off scot-free, even though she violated the Espionage Act. Any lieutenant or colonel in the military who did what she did with classified information would be in prison.
Absolutely.
And in fact, many are. Even when their actions were entirely unintentional, when they accidentally took home from work a laptop that contained, unbeknownst to them, classified information on it, they frequently get prosecuted and thrown in jail. Hillary Clinton had hundreds of emails containing confidential information, and it was fully known to James Comey, and he refused to apply the law, refused to prosecute her simply because she was Hillary Clinton, and he advocated anybody but Trump. He was an anti-Trumper, and he wanted to do whatever he could to do that. And then, of course, we have this gross abuse of power by Comey and by the entire intelligence establishment leadership to try to create this false narrative using going to the FISA courts with a dossier, the Steele dossier, that they knew was fabricated. They knew it was fabricated, and they swore out affidavits in support of it, falsely representing to the court that it was valid. Certifying those false representations in the Steele dossier, which are laughably false. I don't understand how any judge could possibly construe that to be a valid basis for allowing such an investigation. Nevertheless, this is all examples. These are all examples of gross abuse of power, and this is third world country stuff.
Absolutely.
This is stuff that results in the overthrow. This was an attempted coup in the United States. We're fortunate it was exposed. We're very unfortunate that the rule of law has not been applied thus far. Now we're going to see what happens with the Durham investigation, but hopefully we will see prosecutions, and they need to go all the way back up to Hillary Clinton, mm-hmm. who's behind this dossier 100%. And we ought to see a full application of the law. These people need to be held to account. It's the only way the public will have confidence that the rule of law exists, that the FBI is actually a law enforcement office instead of a political department of the Democratic Party.
Do you think it ever would get to Hillary Clinton? Because I've seen some intelligence analysts that say, look, they'll get some underlying people, some of which have already been identified, but it will never get up to Hillary, which is unfortunate because we know for a fact, thanks to Brennan's own handwritten notes in the White House, that Obama and Biden and Comey and Brennan and Clapper all knew that this was a false information.
We have to have it apply. We have to go back, and we have to have this Durham investigation proceed. And I suspect when Republicans take over the House and Senate, we're going to see justice be imposed. I believe that we're going to see all of this exposed in committee hearings, but I also believe that ultimately, when a Republican takes the White House, I suspect in 2024, I hope, then we will see the Justice Department and the Attorney General be able to function properly. As long as we have this Attorney General in office, I don't think we're going to see any activity at all because he's already shown his aversion to doing anything that affects Biden's interests. Just take a look at the Hunter situation, Hunter Biden. You've got classic influence peddling. Now we have proof that the money that Hunter derived from his illicit interactions with foreign powers that were enemies of the United States based on false influence, on influence peddling, went into an account that was used by Joe Biden in part to finance his own expenses. So you have proof positive of a massive corruption on the part of the president and Hunter Biden that needs to be thoroughly vetted, and it is not. Or at least if it is, if there is an investigation taking place, it certainly is on the slowest course possible. And this is all because of political influence. This needs to be thoroughly vetted. It needs to be explored. It can be done very rapidly. They need to use all the power of the government to determine the full extent of this corruption. And those who are responsible for violating the laws need to be prosecuted. And if this president is guilty of crimes, he needs to be exposed, and we need to take the appropriate steps after that.
Well, okay, so wishful thinking here, but if it was to get to the level of Biden, that he knew about the whole Russia gate investigation, the being false and whatnot, that this was essentially the attempted coup, could he be removed for such a charge?
Oh, you bet. You know, it's obstruction of justice. It's fraud. It is a violation of his oath, of course, and it's also an abuse of power. But most fundamentally and very clearly, these are actions that are part of a conspiracy to defraud and to abuse the powers of office, abuse public trust, and abuse resources, misallocate resources intentionally for illegal and illicit purposes. All of this they were complicit in, apparently, and privy to, perhaps all the way up to Obama and perhaps also to Joe Biden. In any event, all the evidence seems to point in those directions, and
sure
it needs to be followed and see the extent to which this is adequately substantiated. And to the extent that it is, we need indictments, we need prosecutions, and we need to throw these turkeys in jail.
Oh, absolutely.
We cannot have in this country this kind of gross abuse of power, an attempted coup d'etat, to be countenanced for fear that it will recur and that others will think that they can get away with it. We have to ensure the full prosecution of the law here, or else we're going to lose our republic.
That's exactly right. And if there's justice in America, that's exactly what needs to happen. Jonathan E. Morton, I want to thank you so much for your time today. This has been great.
You bet.
As usual, Jonathan has so much information that it's really worth listening to a second time. So with Thanksgiving next week, we're going to be re-airing this. From all of us here, we wish you the best of Thanksgivings. Jonathan's book, one more time, is The Authoritarians. You'll want to read this book. You can't defeat an enemy if you don't understand that enemy. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.